He says, "You write that wars are necessary to control the population explosion and to give people an opportunity for self-sacrifice. What is the karmic effect on such war heroes who perhaps give up their own life fighting for their country but in the process kill or maim many of their enemies that they have never even seen before? When, or if, they should meet again somewhere in the hereafter would they ask, 'Are you the SOB who killed me?' And how does someone gain merit for fighting a war and killing someone even if they lose their own life? The laws of karma are different when a person is fighting in defense of his home, his family and his country, so that if you are ordered into the forces you really have no choice, you have to go. And once you are in the forces you come under a blanket protection so that the people who give the orders, basically the governments, have to accept the karmic results of those orders. You, Private AB, are sent to the war front. You have a rifle in your hands, and at a certain time you may be told to fire that rifle. You have to obey your orders or you may get killed for disobedience. So you pull the trigger and a bullet kills one of the enemy. The karmic effect of it is not yours, you do not have to worry about it. The karmic effect is assumed by the person or persons who actually caused the war. When you get to the other side you do not have to meet the person you killed or the person who killed you. Only if you have no dislike and no hatred of those persons can you meet them. Certainly you can gain merit by preventing atrocities. Suppose a little troop of men are able to ambush members of the opposition, the enemy who are setting out to massacre a lot of women and children. Perhaps they were going to set fire to the houses after they had locked the inhabitants inside. Well, you and your small troop could kill perhaps 20 members of the assassination gang, but in doing so you would have saved possibly 2,000 women, children, and old people, so the balance would be to the good, wouldn't it? And under that heading you would have gained merit. Mrs. Nancy Justice is an old friend of mine, we have been corresponding for I forget how long, but it's quite a long time. Now she writes in and she has some questions. So I think we ought to attend to Mrs. Nancy Justice, don't you? She says, "I am slightly clairvoyant. In your book Wisdom of the Ancients you define clairvoyance as seeing through walls and beyond. What I mean is knowing what is going to happen before it happens. But I can do this to a limited degree only. I have an urge to crystal gaze or something of that sort. I know mirrors seem to draw my eyes, and I read somewhere of mirrors that were used once upon a time where they painted one side or something. Could you tell me how to do this?" "Well, Mrs. Justice, I have just been writing about crystals and how to use them. So I think that actually does answer most of your question, but very definitely I would not advise you to use a black mirror, because if used carelessly they are very, very dangerous things indeed and enable mischievous entities to work harm through you. So take my advice and have nothing whatever to do with these black mirrors. A crystal cannot harm you in any way at all." You go on, "I see that you talk a lot about the astral and traveling by astral. Also I believe you when you say that no harm can come to you. But I am one of those strange persons who is deathly afraid of hypnotism, even self-hypnosis. What I wanted to ask you is it true that when you are deeply engrossed in reading something, like reading a book to the point that you are not aware of outside influence, well, that is a form of hypnosis. No harm can happen when you are doing astral travel unless you are afraid. But then you can be harmed if you take fright, even if you are crossing the road. You might run the wrong way. I am definitely opposed to hypnosis. I am also opposed to self-hypnosis because it is so easy to do it the wrong way, easier to do it the wrong way than it is to do it the right way, in fact. So stay clear of all forms of hypnosis, they are bad. But rest quite assured that when you are reading a book you are not hypnotized. Instead you are merely interested and that is absolutely safe." You give a third question, "Mrs. Justice, and it is so applicable that I am going to answer it here now. You're right, you keep saying that to try all the different things in your book that nothing will ever happen to you like being possessed. Fine, but how did those people who are possessed get that way? What did they do or not do? That's a fair enough question. But you will remember just above that I have been telling you not to do hypnosis. I have been telling you not to use black mirrors. So if you do and try these things then you can easily get possessed. I am telling you throughout all my books how not to get possessed, and if you follow what I write then you cannot get possessed. But if you disregard what I am saying then you will get possessed, which is what you want to know about. Black mirrors, black magic, hypnosis and some of those ear boards can lead you astray, you can get hypnotized with them, you can get possessed. And this is why I say time after time don't do it. Chapter 12. Everyone here is very busy. Normally I like to type a lot of my books myself and then have Buttercup retype them on her Olympia typewriter. Henry Mendelssohn gave me a typewriter which I have named the Yellow Peril, but I have not been able to use it much on this book, my health has not permitted, and so most of this book has been dictated on a Sony tape recorder, just a small pocket thing, so I can claim kinship with Mr. Nixon. He used Sony recorders for his Watergate tapes, I believe. Buttercup is a marvelous typist, extremely fast and extraordinarily accurate. It is a matter of much jubilation when she makes a mistake, because it's nice to tell her that she is not perfect after all. But we hear a tramp resident so a very great deal to Buttercup, and without her we should have a much harder time. So thank you, Buttercup Rouse. Mrs. Ramper is a hard worker, too. She goes through the pages of the typescript with an eagle eye, and between them Buttercup and Mrs. Ramper not many mistakes get by, and if I make a mistake in my dictation, my goodness me, I never hear the last of it. Buttercup comes on me like 10 tons of bricks, and there is no peace until I have rectified the error of omission or commission or some other mission. My sympathy, though, goes to the poor wretched typesetters who have to set up books, because it must be a horrifying thing indeed to have to set up in print a book which you find boring or in which you just can't get any interest. I would just hate to be a typesetter. As I am sitting here in my wheelchair I can see our little river outside, and there are two boat loads of crazy people paddling away as if they were Red Indians on the warpath. The weather is quite cold, and our river is dangerous. It is silted up quite a lot, and there are, for the size of the river, immense sandbanks which channel the water through a narrow space and so increase its speed and set up whirlpools. We are always reading that someone has been drowned or fished out of the water, and yet people still go in it on old tires or anything they can dig up. Oh well, good for the funeral homes, I suppose. Now, I've got another question here which I have already answered, but I am going to answer it again in, possibly, a different form in order that someone may get a different slant on the thing. The question is, what is meant by the statement, when the student is ready the master appears? Too many people think that they know all and plenty more besides. They think that they just have to whistle and hordes of masters come panting with eagerness to teach such a bright person. It doesn't happen that way at all. You know those kettles, you shove them on the gas or electricity, and when the water boils they let out a horrendous hoot. Well, people are like that. When their vibrations reach a certain pitch, that is, when they are ready, a master somewhere, either on the earth or in the astral, can pick up a vibration which says, metaphorically of course, hey boss, I'm ready, come and teach me all you know. So after the master has given a luxurious stretch and a hearty scratch, he might get to his feet, or even to his astral feet, and come along to give a hand. But nearly always the person who thinks that he or she is such a brilliant student that he or she is ready, well, they are the ones who just are not ready, and no matter how much they hoot or let off steam, until their vibrations reach the right pitch or frequency no master will appear. So if a master doesn't appear it is proof positive that you are not ready. Who is this? Astare Mori. Okay Astare, here is your second question, how does race karma affect an individual? Before a person reincarnates to Earth that person goes to what we may somewhat humorously regard as a travel agent in the astral. Actually it is a council of advisors. But the person who is going to come back to Earth knows what has to be done, where he or she has to go, and what the circumstances should be for doing that particular task or lesson. So one of the things is that one takes into account the basic karma of the race to which one is coming. One comes to a race whose karma is suitable for increasing one's opportunities for doing the allotted task. Apart from that, race karma doesn't affect one because it is more to do with the manu of the race. Well now, Esther Murray has another question here. She seems to be a nice young lady, so let's spare her a few more minutes, shall we? Her third question is, what can an individual do to reincarnate with the same family they now have, or is this not possible? I have just been telling you how things are planned. So if it is necessary for people to come together in another life, then they will come together in another life, and arrangements are made for that specific purpose. You might remember the case of the girl in India. She died as a child, and then she came back as a child to a family who lived just a few miles away, and she kept on talking about her other family. Many inquiries were made, and eventually the two families were brought together, and the reincarnated girl was able to give proof that she had reincarnated. That is a case which is authenticated beyond all possible doubt. Now, here is a question for you. Mermen and mermaids, were these truly a race of people, and if so, what intellect did they possess and what happened to them? Actually, all that the average person knows about mermaids and mermen goes back to the days of Atlantis. Now, Atlantis was a far more technically accomplished place than this present-day civilization. People could be made, lumps of protoplasm could be formed in somewhat human shape, and they were used as servants, not as slaves. They were used as servants because they were people of inferior mentality. They were, in fact, made for the purpose of serving their masters and mistresses. Theoretically, nowadays it is possible to increase the mentality of a dog or a horse or something like that by being irradiated by special rays and by being fed special chemicals. In that way, the brain voltages can be altered, and so the intelligence factor increased. There is no reason, for instance, why monkeys should not be altered by chemicals so that their mentality is greatly increased, and thus they could, in effect, be a sort of servant to people. I know quite recently at the Calgary Stampede procession, when we had all manner of things going through the city streets, there was one monkey riding a horse, and he was wearing clothes. He was doffing his hat to the onlookers and behaving in every way the same as the humans around him. Except for looks, one couldn't have told the difference so far as behavior was concerned. And that old monkey, he certainly got a lot of applause, too. But then the applause upset his self-control, because he jumped off the horse and jumped at the spectators, and he was horribly affectionate with them, and it was quite a task, I understand, to get him back on his horse again. You mentioned that in the astral world we can have families. Do we leave them for a while to attend class on Earth and then return to them at the end of our Earth class? Yes, that is quite possible. You may say that we spend 24 hours a day on Earth. Certainly we do, but they are Earth hours, and time in the astral world is utterly different from the time on Earth. In fact, in some of the Hindu books there are stories of people going away from the Earth and spending a little time in the astral, and then on their return to Earth finding that 1,000 years of Earth time has passed. So it is perfectly feasible for a person to come to Earth and do all manner of things by day, but the person has to sleep, and during the sleep the astral bodies go back to the astral world, no matter whether people remember rightly or not. And the time they spend in the astral world with their families may be perhaps twice as long as they stay on Earth by day. It is all a question of the difference in time. This next question makes me wonder if some poor soul has been brought up the hard way, because the question is, if a child were pushed through college in his life by a hard-hearted parent, would it necessarily help the child in his or her successive lives? Oh dear, dear, I am so sorry to have to disappoint you. But the answer is yes. Everything we learn, everything we experience is worthwhile, and it is saved. Now, a better way to explain it would perhaps be to say that when we go over to the other side, we take all the good that we have learned on Earth, and all the bad, the dross, is left behind. It's like if you are melting a metal, if you are melting gold, for instance, or silver, well, you melt the stuff and then sludge forms on the top. Because gold or silver is heavier than sludge, it forms as a dirty mass which is skimmed off and thrown away, leaving the gold or the silver to be poured into ingots. Well, we are in much the same state. All that which we have learned, which is of use to the overself and to our development, is retained. The bad is discarded like a bad memory. People are interested in the astral, aren't they? So here is another one about the astral. It is, If I were able to astral travel consciously and my wife had been trying without success, 1. Could I evaluate from the astral what she was doing wrong and help her to correct the situation? 2. Would it in any way be wrong to help in this manner? The answer is that of course you can go into the astral and find out what the problem is, and of course you can come back and tell her what the problem is. But I can tell you what the problem is now, it is just a matter of memory. She does astral travel. Knowing who you are, and not telling, I know that your wife has been to see me in the astral, and so have you, and you made a big splash about it, too. But your wife is trying too hard, or she may have a little fear. But if she would only take things quietly and not make such efforts, then she would remember the astral travels that she did. Now, here is a bit more which really relates to the Hollow Earth. Since the publication of your books, I would imagine that the Chinese have tried to find the passageways in the mountain and the underground river. How could it remain so well hidden from such an intensive search? The answer is, through masterly misdirection. If you see a blank wall ahead of you and all your tests, including the use of special detectors, etc., convince you that the wall is solid, then you turn elsewhere, and the wall is indeed very well protected, because if one goes down far enough one gets to an outpost of the Hollow Earth. You further ask about the approximate date of the underground tunnels. Well, I should say about 1 million years, or so, ago, because they were made well before Atlantis. They were made when first people went underground, and into the inner world. In passing, let me say that although a lot of people will screech with laughter at the thought of a hollow earth, let me remind them that for centuries and centuries people thought that the earth was flat, and if anybody had dared to say that the earth was round, then they would have been taken as insane people, because they would have said, if the world is round, how can we stand on it? What about the people on the other side of the earth? They would fall off for sure. We know otherwise, don't we? We know the earth is round and not flat. Some of us know that the world is hollow, too. Think of that, will you? Respected sir, you have got your facts mixed up somewhere, or dropped a brick, or you haven't been reading my books properly. You say, why would a race of people from far out in space want to colonize with the people of this world to produce the race of Dan? Well, who said there was going to be a colony coming from beyond space? Just think of this. Get all the white people, the yellow people, the red people, the black people, and any other color or shade you can scrape up, get them all to intermarry, and look at the result. What would the color be? Tan, of course. And so we can get the race of tan when we get all the peoples of the world intermarrying, because in those days color will not matter. It doesn't matter in Brazil nowadays. It is one place on the face of this earth where the black man and the white man work side by side with no thought whatever of color. I have a very soft spot for Brazil because they are doing well, and it is one of the coming countries. They will be the first to produce citizens for the race of Dan. In the Hermit it was stated that the gardeners would place someone on this earth for the hermit to tell his story to. How is it meant that you were placed on this earth? Well, somebody had to be picked. And the person who was picked had to have certain qualifications. For instance, he had to be a very hardy individual. He had to be highly telepathic, highly clairvoyant, he had to have a good memory, and he had to have his personal frequency or wavelength of a certain order. In other words, he had to be constantly in touch with one of the great masters. So the poor fellow who did fulfill those qualifications was grabbed and placed in such conditions that he naturally became the listener to the story, and I state that that story is true. Let's have a statement from Paddle Boat Moffat. He says, read the book The Spaceships of Ezekiel by Joseph F. Blumrich. You suggested I read it and it proved very interesting and well written. So the UC Paddle Boat Moffat, now a member of the Paddle Boat Club, is able to take advice, to act upon advice, and to profit from advice. He's a good fellow, too. Here is a question from Wilhelm Briceno. He is 18 years of age and he lives in Venezuela. His first question is there any part of the world in which the original religion taught by Christ is now practiced? No, I am sorry to say that there is not. Christ departed the scene and for many years the teachings of Christ were let lapse. But after a number of years, a gang of people thought they would start something which would give them some power. Really, the early founders of the Christian Church, as it was then, were a lot of cultists. They did not teach that which Christ taught, but they taught that which increased their own power. For example, most of the bunch were paralyzed with fright at the thought of women. Christ did not teach that women were unclean. Mind you, I'm sure Christ would not have liked that women's liber person who writes to me. But Christ taught that women had rights just as men have rights. But the founders of the church in the year 60 did not want women to get any power at all, so it was taught that women had no souls, women were unclean, some of them are by the amount of stuff they put on their face. However, to answer the question, no, on no place at all of this earth is the original teaching of Christ followed. Is there in existence now the original version of the Bible? If not, what can one do to enable Christianity to be taught as it was originally intended to be taught? Well, if we could find the original version of the Bible, we could still not return to basic Christianity, because the Bible is just a collection of books consisting of the gospel according to, and as I have been saying, the Bible is not necessarily the teachings of Christ. Most of the people in Christ's time couldn't write, anyway. If animals are also intelligent, why don't they make temples and houses, and why don't they leave any culture in history? But are you sure they don't? You see, it doesn't mean that a person is civilized or intelligent because one builds a temple or church. I've got one in front of me now, which is a concrete monstrosity done in the form of an Indian wigwam, that is, tent-shaped with three imitation poles sticking up from the roof. It's a church all right, but in the form of a teepee, which was a tent of the Indians who, anyway, weren't Christians. So how is there any symbolism in that? To my own definite knowledge, animals are intelligent, but their intelligence takes a different form from that of humans. Humans seem to want to build great buildings so that some other humans can come along and drop bombs on it or shell the cities which humans make. I never understand people who think that humans are the lords of creation. They are not. On this particular world, admittedly, they dominate by force. But do you know that only humans and spiders commit rape? No other animals at all do. You say about building things, but how about the bees? How about the ants? They have very wonderful civilizations. Ants have fortresses, they have a very effective army, they have cleaners, street cleaners, they have nursemaids and all the rest of it. They even have their milk cows, which are aphids. Animals are here for their own particular purpose and for their own particular evolution, and I know from my own personal intensive studies that animals can be highly intelligent, some more intelligent than humans. I say that with a full sense of responsibility, and unless you are clairvoyant and telepathic, as I am, then you cannot truthfully contradict me, because you would be like a person who was born blind and who would say that there were no such colors as red, green, yellow, etc., etc. Unless you have the same abilities as I have, then you cannot dispute what my superior abilities enable me to know. In the same way, I cannot walk, so it's useless for me to argue with you if you say that it's a very pleasant thing walking over such and such a surface. I wouldn't know, I know my own subjects. Rosemary, that is the only name of hers I have here, writes to me and says, in your next book, would it be possible for you to dwell a little on the causes of a dual personality? You see, I have a dual personality. Does that mean I have great difficulty in following the middle way? I tend to go to extremes. No, Rosemary, it doesn't mean that you are any different from anyone else. It means that you came here to overcome certain defects, and so that you could see what it was like you came as a dual personality. I assume that in a previous life, perhaps in your very last life even, you could not get on with people, and somebody said you couldn't get on with yourself. So, in effect, you said, all right, I'll go back to Earth as a dual personality and you'll see how well I do. A dual personality is just one who has an astrological makeup which causes them to see two sides of the coin at once, surely quite a feat, but it doesn't mean you are any better or any worse than anyone else. It might even mean that it was intended that you should be twins, you know, identical twins where one egg divides, but for some reason the egg did not divide, and in that case you get a form of dual entity inside one body. Never mind, Rosemary, I will tell you here and now that you are doing very well indeed, and there is not the slightest reason why you should be worried, so don't be. We've got time for one more question, I think, and this is from Mr. Howard G. Marsh. I get quite a lot of people writing to me from Idaho. All right, Mr. Marsh, you mention in one of your books that a person has to come back to Earth for every sign of the zodiac. This would be 12 times if he learned his lessons well. Am I correct? Mr. Marsh, I have to tell you that you are not correct. A person has to come back and live through every sign of the zodiac and through every quadrant, 30 degrees, of every sign of the zodiac, and he has to keep coming back until he accomplishes his task successfully in every sign and quadrant of that zodiac. So if he is a slow learner, he might come to Earth 1,000 or 2,000 times, which makes it all a bit monotonous, doesn't it? The tape is spinning on, the day is drawing to a close. Twilight will soon be upon us. The pages of this book are mounting up and the words of its total are exceeding that which is considered necessary for this book. Before me I have questions, piles of questions enough for many more books to come. And who knows? I might yet write another book. There's life in the old man yet. I can still twitch a little. I am still able to push a recorder button. So if you do want another book, you know how to get it. All you have to do is to write to my publisher and tell him you want another book by Lobsang Rampa. For the present, then, I will take leave of you, and in doing so bring this book, Twilight, to its end. The end. 291-293-